Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the long-gone Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 still, though, every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Detective Superintendent Liz Hughes is from Avon and Somerset Police Child Protection Squad. We have a look, hear what she's got to say about the 14-year sentence for a child abuse victim, Carl Beach, who came to the police and ended up doing 14 years in prison. Quite a frightening experience for him, and will it put off other people going forward to the police? Also, Carolyn Shires, she's a victim of Lloyds Bank fraud, the office in Castle Park. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you've got someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show. And we start with some music from Fun Boy 3 from 1983. Terry Hall is the singer and songwriter, and he himself was abducted by a paedophile ring, aged 12. Singer-songwriter Terry Hall there and his band Fun Boy 3 back in 1983. I'm not sure what most of the DJs and the listeners thought that song was about, but it was actually Terry writing about his experience being abducted by a paedophile ring when he was aged 12. So we hear now from Detective Superintendent Liz Hughes from Avon and Somerset Child Protection Squad.
My name is Liz Hughes. I'm one of the detective superintendents working for Avon and Somerset Constabulary. My role is one of the ones in the investigations department. So what your listeners might commonly think of as some of the sort of CID sort of programs that I might watch on television, my role is managing those teams across our force area. And we deal with all the serious and complex crime that's reported to us, which includes child abuse investigations.
Can you just tell us something about the minutiae? Well, not maybe the minutiae, but how does something come from you looking at it to actually being prosecuted and arriving in the courts? Because I know the Crown Prosecution Service now play a big role there.
They're absolutely critical partners in working with us. You know, so in terms of what you've just asked me there, obviously the initial call might come into us from a victim who has decided that they wish to disclose to us something that's happened to them. That might be something really recently, or in some of the cases, you know, we also get reported that might be something that's happened a long time ago to them, but they finally sort of, you know, reached a position where they want to share that with us so that we can investigate. And obviously I work with a team of officers who will look at that allegation and that crime, and then we will investigate by taking statements, interviewing the victim who's reported it to us. And, you know, if it's a really recent investigation, we might look at CCTV, we might look at telephone records. If it's a more historic investigation, then we'll have other lines we might consider, like old records and looking for other witnesses.
Do you ever get to the situation where you think you've got enough evidence to prosecute someone and the Crown Prosecution says no? Crown Prosecution Service says no?
Quite often. So there is a code for Crown Prosecutors. We work closely with Crown Prosecutors. What will usually happen will be we will submit our evidence to them in terms of where we feel we've reached the evidential threshold for prosecution. Quite often they will helpfully, because they are impartial, look at that and ask us whether we can strengthen elements of it, or whether they think we've missed opportunities, and that might come back to us from an action plan to review and to progress. But it is very much a team effort. The Crown Prosecution Service and the police, you know, do want to prosecute people who've committed crime. So it is a useful and helpful relationship.
I mean, I can just tell you a brief story about my own childhood. I can remember learning to swim 5-6 years old. We used to go down there once a week to the swimming pool, and there were sort of hints and allegations that one of the instructors was, you know, we should keep away from him. You know, he was a bit of a funny guy, potentially there for, I mean, and this is as a really young child being taught this. It does make you wonder whereabouts the people who really are paedophiles, so this is completely different to just having an allegation like that, whereabouts they hang out in society. Where should we be wary to particularly look for child abusers?
So I wouldn't want to sort of create an alarmist message, but I think, you know, people do need to consider, you know, and safeguard children at all times. It's absolutely a fundamental, you know, right of any society to protect the vulnerable, including children. You know, there are some academic theories which suggest that children who have an interest in children will, you know, have jobs or, you know, create circuits.
Children who have an interest in children.
Oh, sorry. So people who have an interest in children, you know, may perhaps take jobs which give them access to children. You know, in the media we have heard of, you know, individuals befriending particular families to build up relationships with their children. We can't be naive. There are people in society who do have that predatory interest, but it's absolutely all of our role to safeguard that. But I wouldn't be able to give your listeners a list of locations or a list of, you know, roles to avoid, you know, of where paedophiles hang out.
What about this word paedophile? Because we seem to be hearing it more and more, including attributed to the American Jeffrey Epstein, where actually it does look as if it was underage girls that were being trafficked to him and by him. I mean, isn't there a difference really between abuse of children who are below the age of puberty and those above? It seems as if everything is now being caught up with this term paedophilia. I wonder what the law says about whether there's any difference.
So the abuse of children is the abuse of children. The law is quite clear that children, for, you know, are under 18. Certainly, in terms of some of the legislation that we use, there's specific differentiation between children under 13 and over 13. But for me, children is children. I know there is a legal definition of, or a Latin definition of, paedophilia, but absolutely, you know, we treat all abuse of children extremely seriously and use whatever laws we can to make sure that they're safeguarded.
What about this recent case of Carl Beach? Now, he came forward to the police with allegations. This is, I suppose, was probably best known as the VIP pedophile scandal. He is now doing 18 years in prison, and there are those that suggest that maybe because of that, people shouldn't come forward to the police because they may end up in jail themselves, even though they've come forward to police as survivors of child abuse.
I think my message would be really clear that I want anybody, whether they're an adult or child, to feel confident to come forward to the police to report allegations to us so that we can safeguard them, safeguard others who still may be in contact with the person who abused them. Because even if an allegation has happened a long time ago, that perpetrator may still have access to other children. And that's a real critical thing for me, that we need to safeguard everybody we can. In terms of that specific case, you know, we look after victims. We look at the evidence that's available. We make sure that they have the right support. There's fantastic organisations called The Bridge, of which, you know, there's good access to counsellors. So I wouldn't want victims to be afraid. I would absolutely want them to encourage them to come forward, because, you know, victims who have suffered from sexual abuse, you know, suffer a tremendous amount of trauma. And even if they're not confident perhaps to disclose to the police, talking to an organisation like The Bridge can give them access to counselling and enable them to sort of start some of that healing process.
The supporters of Carl Beach would say that actually he made the mistake of going up against a very wealthy and powerful person, Harvey Proctor, who was himself actually a sex offender. He was convicted in May 1987, and that if the person that you're testifying against is wealthy and powerful, then you may as well not bother.
I disagree with that. We treat all allegations seriously. I don't differentiate between, you know, anybody in power. If we had an a crime reported to us today, then we would absolutely investigate, you know, to the best of our ability. So I don't really want to be drawn into that. For me, you know, perhaps many years ago, people may have had more power and influence, but I do think from a policing perspective, there's good safeguards in place. If we had a report of anyone in a position of public prominence or anyone in a position of trust, then we would absolutely treat that seriously and respond with the greatest of integrity.
In the case of Harvey Proctor, he's been awarded £900,000 in damages. And it's not necessarily about the power of somebody, but their wealth to basically pay for an army of lawyers to fight whoever it is that's making these allegations against them.
The criminal justice system, you know, equally has its own access to eminent barristers. So for me, again, that wouldn't be a blocker for someone coming forward to make sure that if we did have somebody who was abusing children or had abused children in their past, that we took, you know, we would absolutely not see that as a reason for not going forward with an allegation. And in terms of, you know, we've had some really good prosecutions recently of historical allegations against adults where they have been prosecuted for crimes, you know, that were committed many decades ago against children.
What about the Jimmy Savile case and Jeffrey Epstein? Of course, Savile was dead before people realised what he was up to, supposedly. Does you think it brought any kind of real change in attitudes from the police about the way they deal with these sorts of accusations?
I think that there's been... The policing has always treated sexual abuse and child sexual abuse as really serious allegations, and they've always been investigated by detectives with a specialist background. Certainly from my experience of the last, I've been a police officer for 24 years, my experience over the last sort of decade or so, there is a much greater understanding of the seriousness of these offences. The sort of the training delivered by the College of Policing in terms of perhaps the specialist skills you may need to address and support victims and investigating these offences. I think that from a policing point of view, we've really sharpened up our act in the last few years.
I mean, the Epstein case, for example, we've seen Ghislaine Maxwell, who was quite clearly very much involved in trafficking young girls, and also Jean-Luc Brunel, a photographer, was also involved in this case. Well, they're still alive, but they're just sort of, they've disappeared. What do you do about people like that? They seem to be able to just vanish into thin air.
There's lots of different tactics we can do. Obviously, I don't know the specifics of that investigation, but I think, you know, in relation to the sort of the disruption techniques and the different laws we can use now, certainly in relation to moving children around for the purposes of sexual sort of assaults, we can use some of the modern slavery legislation, and you know, there's lots of opportunities. Certainly, you know, as I say, I can't comment on that particular investigation, but again, you know, somebody's position, if you had good evidence to suggest that that's what was happening, or you needed to collect evidence, we you know, from an organisational point of view, we would never shy away from that responsibility.
Can you tell us if any of your cases that you've dealt with over the last few years that you felt particularly prove your point that you do take these allegations seriously and that people may go to jail as a result?
So in terms of my teams, you know, they work tirelessly on these investigations, and certainly the last couple of weeks we've had two really significant offences which have reached court that have been offences against people in their 70s and 80s who've recently been accused and investigated for committing offences sort of almost 20, 30 years ago. So certainly there was an 86-year-old who's recently been convicted for 14 years, and that was for sexual offences committed in the 70s against young girls. There was also another case recently where there was an 8.5-year sentence, I believe, against a lady perpetrator, which is, you know, slightly more unusual, and that was against boys also committed in the sort of the 70s and 80s as well.
Do you think there was a time when this sort of thing was considered acceptable? It does seem that way, that almost pre-Savile, people thought they could do this and get away with it.
I absolutely don't think that sexual abuse of children was ever acceptable. I think where there perhaps was a slight difference was in relation to physical assaults years ago, where people saw chastisement, as acceptable. But certainly now, that's not acceptable. But sexual abuse, no, I don't. I think there's always been really strong laws around sexual abuse and protecting children. So I would say that that has always been an absolute criminal offence, and society would recognise it as that.
How do you explain then these grooming gangs that have been going sometimes for 20 years, we hear, places like Rotherham, 1,400 sexual assaults apparently in Rochdale, a lot there, and also just this week in Manchester, a grooming gang apparently assaulting 80 girls with no prosecutions, even though these gangs were reported to the police many times?
So I think we've changed the way we investigate child sexual abuse sometimes, because I think what's been learned historically is that some of the girls, despite being clear victims of sexual abuse to us, sometimes don't see themselves as victims, and so they've been, you know, reluctant to report offences to the police. So in terms of some of those older cases you've just referred to there, I think that was largely the case, where in some cases, you know, the girls would not sort of explain to any agencies or the police what was going on. And certainly now we have Operation Topaz in our force, which is a group of detectives led really brilliantly by a detective sergeant who, when we gather intelligence and we understand about different networks of child sexual perpetrators, we go and disrupt the perpetrator. And what we found is that by doing that, and then by making contact with the children, they are more likely to disclose to us and tell us what's been happening to them when we've got that person sort of safely in custody.
We've also seen the Bishop of Gloucester, Peter Ball, who was even apparently trying to use alibis when actually it was his twin brother who was in the cathedral giving services. We've seen just this week Chichester priest Marion Griffiths. Are there special considerations, do you think, for the church? Because obviously these are positions of great trust in society.
So they are positions of trust in society. From a policing point of view, we would treat them exactly the same as any other allegation that's reported to us. Obviously, the Independent Inquiry for Child Sexual Abuse has recently, you know, done some significant work on the church and different offences that have been investigated there. And there was some real learning to come out of that in terms of the way the organisation needs to sort of manage it itself. But from my point of view, from a policing point of view, certainly when we've looked at those areas, we've taken really robust action on behalf of victims.
There are some ex-police officers, one guy called John Wedger, I think was a detective constable in London, who said that still it is possible that children, particularly in care homes, are regularly abused because those children just simply don't feel they can come to the police. They don't feel the police are going to help them. And when an investigation does take place, it's shut down at a very high level, at least in London. That's what he was saying.
So I don't think things are shut down. You know, we will try and build rapport with any child victim who wants to speak to us. I think you're right. Sometimes, you know, those children who've had quite traumatic childhoods may be more reluctant to build relationships with the police. And that's where we need to work really strongly with our multi-agency partners, whether that's social care or the voluntary or sort of other charitable groups. So for example, we work closely with Barnardo's and BASE, who will build up really good relationships with children they're working through a key worker relationship. And it is about building trust and confidence with that child to then enable them to feel confident to sort of disclose to the police and for us to be able to record their account in an evidential way.
So for anyone that's reluctant to come forward to the police or knows people who are reluctant to come forward, what have you got to say to them?
I would ask them to trust us. You know, there are a lot of fantastic officers who I work with every day who are trained to speak to children. They genuinely care about what happens to children. They understand that actually talking to the police can be quite an intimidating thing. But actually, we've got lots of people who would really support any child who wants to, or any adult who's been through that level of abuse who would like to come and talk to us.
There are some that say they've been through decades of knowing stories and just simply haven't felt confident enough to come to the police. You know, maybe things have happened a long time ago.
I think those just a minute ago, we talked about those two cases. You know, they made reports by, you know, people who are well into their adult lives now who have been really impacted by offences that were committed to them as children. And I would just say it's never too late. You know, there's fantastic support for people. And also, I would just really urge them, because some of those people who are, you know, did perpetrate crimes against them, you know, still may have access to other children. And, you know, we'd urge people to come forward so that we can safeguard others as well.
What are the rules about anonymity? Because sometimes people might not wish to give their name, might not wish to see their name in lights in the paper, particularly associated with a case like child sexual abuse.
So we don't issue any victim details at all. That, you know, the victim's right is to keep anonymous.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Detective Superintendent Liz Hughes, Avon Somerset Child Protection Squad. And if you want to contact the police or your friend that wants to, you can do so via 101. Or if you don't want to contact the police direct, you could contact this show for a bit independent advice.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Both Royal Bank of Scotland and Lloyds have been taking people's money. That is to say, closing businesses, thousands, some of them. And what they've been doing is by rearranging loans, what they call bait and switch. That is to say, people who've taken out loans are baited into changing those loans. They're switched onto a new system which has massively increases their repayments. This bait and switch system is really a kind of contract that both of these banks have been up to, and we have to see what happens through various court cases to do with it. But anyway, we're going to hear now from Carolyn Shires. She's a victim of fraud from Lloyds Bank, she believes. And the other thing is, at the moment, there's also an enormous scandal breaking in the Times newspaper and various other papers about banks forging signatures. That we'll be hearing of, I'm sure, much more in the next few months. But first, Carolyn Shires.
My name is Carolyn Shires. And I first had contact with Lloyds Bank back in the end of 2007, early 2008, when I opened an account with them to help to get a loan to help to finance a farm that I had, a 42-acre farm, which I kept horses and some exotic livestock on, and that. I was first introduced to Lloyds there then.
So what were you planning to do with the loan, and what happened at that point?
I was actually planning to have work done on the farm, and also to stock with some exotic animals, most importantly, what they call Bojet de Poitou donkeys, which are giant donkeys with long hair. I'd also got llamas and angora goats and horses. And at that time I had wallabies.
Did you have a business plan for all of this? And Lloyds Bank normally insist on that, don't they?
I did have a business plan, but I have to say, at the initial think it was quite strange, because although I was requesting help, I hadn't actually, I did a sort of business plan, but I wasn't actually going to set up the business. I planned to get the farm straight before I started the business.
So can I ask how much the loan was for?
It was for $100,000.
And what happened? What happened next? Did things go to plan?
They did, although with hindsight, at the time I felt very uncomfortable after a little while. No sooner had things started to be set up than I felt very uncomfortable about my bank manager. He, with hindsight, I obviously did feel uncomfortable. I had just reasons for being uncomfortable. As soon as I requested the loan, he tried to sell me business loan insurance, which I didn't want because I'd already got insurance from my previous employer. He tried to sell me the business loan insurance, and it made me feel very uneasy, but I was really keen to get the farm set up and to get everything going. So I carried on. I met at my solicitors. I had the land valued, and even then I felt it quite strange because the valuation, I'd already had some money from Barclays, and they'd valued less than a year previously, and Barclays had valued the farm at $500,000. When Lloyds valued the farm just about a year later, they valued it at £300,000, which I thought was a massive difference, and I didn't feel that was right. But my bank manager said to me, "Oh, don't worry," he said, you'll still get money because the valuer is a friend of mine.
So just remind us at what year it was that you initially got this Lloyds loan.
This was December 2007.
One thing is that you have, at that time, I mean, even I can remember, I was signing on in 2007, and I can even remember my bank saying to me, "Do you want a loan?" There were banks were really, you know, quite happy to give loans to almost anybody, it seemed, around about, and this is just before, of course, the financial crisis, the bailouts.
Yes, That's right. Well, the bank manager had been going around the local farms touting for business, and that he went to my local feed store, and that was how I met the bank manager, through my local feed store. Because he was Lloyds Bank, and it was a big bank, I trusted Lloyds Bank, like most people would.
So can you just take us through, blow by blow, how you slowly lost your trust in Lloyds?
I went to my solicitors. My solicitor signed the paperwork. The paperwork was signed for the loan, and the charge was put through in January 2008. Paperwork proves that. But I have recently found, or I found out last year, that actually what I thought was a loan at a very good interest rate, my bank manager had fiddled the paperwork and I'd actually got an overdraft, not a loan, not the loan that I thought I'd got, which was a bit of a surprise. And I was kept on that overdraft for 6 months until May 2008, which, because I didn't receive any statements, I was unaware. I thought I was on 3% of base rate, and instead of that, I was on 14%.
So you're not getting any statements through the post, but, I mean, surely you could have contacted them at any time to find out what your balance was, couldn't you?
Well, unfortunately, at the time, my mother had come to stop for a short length of time, and she'd become ill. And she had a very quick onset of Alzheimer's. Her Alzheimer's had got very bad all of a sudden, and she ended up in hospital. So I found myself distracted from noticing that I hadn't actually received statements.
And it's strange, isn't it? I mean, you would have thought that any account with a bank, you get statements, don't you?
You do, normally, and I hadn't got statements, but I believe that that's quite common with other people who have complained about Lloyds. I believe that's not... I'm not the only person that
has
been.
Okay, so this is 2008. What happened next?
Everything was fine, roughly, until I had difficulties. The loan changed from our interest only to repayment. When it got to that, I found difficulty. I asked Lloyds if they would help me for 3 months.
So you were having trouble making the payments, were you?
I was, yes. And I asked Lloyds if they would help me for 3 months until I received money from where I worked. I could take a leave pension, and I thought, that gave me a lump sum, which helped sort my account out. And also, we were selling my mother's property because she was ill and I was having to struggle to look after the property. And then, therefore, Lloyds would then have been paid off. But they didn't... I tried to discuss that, and I was told by my manager that he didn't really want to know, and he was sending me to the recoveries, which I had no idea what the recoveries was.
Well, they're saying they want their money back.
Exactly. But there was no discussion.
Okay, so how long after you stopped the repayments or weren't able to make the full repayments did that happen?
Well, everything was in the December. And by the March, they sent me to recoveries.
Was that March 2009 or 2008?
That was in 2011.
Oh, okay. So we've been going for a few years now.
We had been going until the end.
That sounded a bit quick. So there's no discussion. A payment is missed, or a payment is only part made, and suddenly they're going to call the loan in. I mean, that doesn't sound normal. Right.
No, but it does seem to be normal for Lloyds. I know that I'm certainly not the only person that has had that.
Okay, so once you were with the recoveries unit, what happened then?
Well, I'm supposed to have been contacted by them, but I didn't hear from them until the June of 2011. And then I tried to discuss with them, and I said that I wanted to pay them back, that I wanted to sort out the account. What I didn't realise was, and also the PPI policy had been put on. I tried to get them to cancel the PPI policy, and they would not cancel the PPI policy.
Well, these have been admitted now to be fraudulent, haven't they, PPI?
They have. I mean, that was £15,000 added to my account, which was a lot of money, and it made the repayments a lot of money.
Okay, so where are we going now in 2011?
2011, I asked them, if I'd have had the £15,000 back, taken off of the debt, and also if the interest rates had been put on what I'd actually agreed to, there would have been no... I would have been in pocket rather than being overdrawn. But Lloyds didn't seem to see it that way. They seem to have a totally different department that deals with PPI policies, and they don't match the two up. And yet they make you a takeout PPI policy on the account that you're taking the loan out.
So what did your solicitor have to say about this? I mean, surely the solicitor would have signed that for you when the loan agreement was signed.
Well, that's right. I have recently tried to contact my solicitor, but unfortunately my solicitor retired about 4 years ago, and they seem to have mislaid the paperwork.
Oh, right. Okay, so they've got their signature on the documents, but that doesn't help. Anyway, so where are we going? 2011?
Lloyds, actually, we've been in contact with the head of recoveries in Lloyds recently. In fact, we're still in contact with him.
So who's that?
And it's Graham Hardy.
Right.
And he has actually admitted that Lloyds cannot find the original paperwork, they cannot find the original loan document, they cannot find the overdraft form, which I know I didn't sign, but I would have had to have signed. They seem to have lost that, and they say that I should have the paperwork and I should be able to produce the paperwork to them. I didn't think that's how banks work. I thought they couldn't have called my loan in without a copy of the
It'd be interesting, wouldn't it? If they go to court to try and get, you know, your money back, they will need to have that agreement and show the judge.
Well, the thing was, they used what they call an LPA receiver with me, which is a Law of Property Act receiver. And Lloyds issue, and they're very crafty, because nobody that I know, and I know 14 people at least, that have had Law of Property Act receivers appointed on their properties by Lloyds, and nobody has ever seen the appointment document. They don't know they've had a receiver appointed until the receiver starts to sell their property. In my case, I didn't know a receiver had been appointed until an estate agent came to my farm gate to actually value the property and take photographs.
So what was it put on the market for by Lloyds?
Lloyds, and this is the joke about it, Lloyds did not put it on the market. Ultimately, Lloyds sold it to my next-door neighbour, a customer of Lloyds, a long-term customer of Lloyds, for £315,000. In that £315,000 that he paid for the property was included all my farm machinery and all my livestock. This has just been admitted to by Graham Hardy from Lloyds in recent correspondence.
So how much do you think that was all worth on top of the property value?
In itself would have been worth... My herd of donkeys was worth a lot of money, so that, with all my livestock, would have easily been the £315,000. So they clearly have sold my property for nothing.
Fascinating. Anyway, so where are we at now? Have you got anywhere? I mean, you're obviously still fighting Lloyd's, as 200 other
Lloyd's.
People are fighting Lloyd's. We've been hearing from Anthony Stansfield, who's the Police and Crime Commissioner of Thames Valley, about this alleged fraud by Lloyd's Bank. And they have two different names for this unit in Castle Park here in Bristol. They call it the Business Support Unit and also the Recoveries Unit. And they apparently are just an overspill. That's what they've told me, from the main Lloyd's building down at the harbour side, which is, you know, very obvious to anyone who's in the Bristol, in the city centre. There's a great big it's a kind of semicircle where the main Lloyd's building is. But this is just an overspill from them. But it does seem to do what they call BSU, Business Support Unit, and Recoveries. So they have, Anthony Stansfield has alleged that the fraud by this unit could be anything up to £1 billion fraud, potentially, from there. We know there's 200 victims, of which you're one, Carolyn. And there are police apparently refusing to take evidence. Now, this is Avon and Somerset
That's
Police.
Right. I mean, I've reported my case to Avon and Somerset Police, who have blatantly haven't looked at the case at all. They've not got in contact with me. I've reported to Action Fraud.
I mean, have they given you a crime number, for example?
No, but Action Fraud did give me a crime number. And they said they'd passed it to Avon and Somerset Police, and I've not heard anything back from Avon and Somerset.
So when did you initially report this as a crime?
This was reported initially at the time, and I did report it again in 2014, I believe.
But
last year had a meeting with Hampshire Police. I've had two meetings with Hampshire Police. One was a very odd meeting on a Sunday morning where the detective and his boss came to ask me to go to Hampshire Basingstoke office, the police office there. They came out and they told me that they couldn't investigate it because they hadn't got enough money. And again, more recently,
The police didn't have enough money to investigate it?
That is what I was told. I was told they didn't have enough money to investigate. I then found more evidence of fraudulent activity with Lloyd's and their LPA receiver that was used on me. I reported that to Hampshire Police in August last year. It took me quite a while to get a meeting. In fact, Anthony Stansfield very kindly got in touch with Hampshire's Crime Commissioner and asked them to get Hampshire Police to look at it. That resulted in a meeting of myself with a detective from Hampshire Police. That I spent all afternoon with the detective going through all my paperwork. He told me that it wasn't the police's responsibility. It came down to Trading Standards. And he got in touch with Trading Standards, and Trading Standards said it wasn't their job to investigate. And he also went to the seller, the agents that sold my property, because which was Carter Jonas from Newbury. They took £600 for advertising my property, and my property wasn't advertised. I put my property on with an estate agent who, I have to say, is an honest estate agent. And he had people come to look at the property through my estate agent, and they were on Carter Jonas's mailing list. And Carter Jonas did not send my property to these people that came to look through at my property.
So it sounds like a bizarre. Now, when was this all going on? When was the property sold? What year?
The property was actually... Well, I received a letter from the so-called solicitors of the receiver, and they also work for Lloyd's, Lyons Davison solicitors in Bristol, because the receiver, the estate agent, obviously Lloyd's, and they're all based in Bristol. I mean, this really is a Bristol crime.
So who were the receivers?
The receivers were somebody called Nicholas Bird from Luscombe Traheen. Now, there are at least nine of us that have had Nicholas Bird, and we've all put in a data subject request to Nicholas Bird to request our files, because there are a number of people, and me included, I've had what they call a statement, but I've not had a breakdown of where my money's gone. I've got so much money, £12,000, I believe, for Nicholas Bird. I don't know what he's done for the £12,000. Lawyers have taken hundreds of thousands of pounds, £190,000, I believe. Carter Jonas took over £10,000, if I remember rightly, for doing nothing much, really.
So where are we at with this now, Carolyn?
Well, we're trying to publicise what's gone on, because we've tried to talk to Lloyds through my MP, and my MP is Jeremy Hunt, and he has asked Lloyds to discuss with us. And the last letter from Lloyds, which came last week, has said that lawyers can find nothing wrong with this and they will not discuss it.
Well, I mean, surely we've gone beyond trying to negotiate with Lloyds, haven't we?
Yes, I mean, I think now it has got to the point where we have to take out a private criminal prosecution against one of the people in Lloyds. And from my paperwork, the sale of my land was sanctioned by John Holliday, who works in recoveries. Now, he actually is in quite a few cases, and he is the person that has signed the appointment documents for the appointment of the likes of Nicholas Bird, and in other cases, the company Alder King, again, based in Bristol.
So, I mean, the good news is that many of these 200 victims are now getting together, Carolyn. I mean, if anyone knows anyone that may have been suffered in a similar way, what's the best thing to do?
The best thing to do, on Noel Edmonds' website, he's put a contact for Mike McGrath, and probably the best thing for them to do is get in touch with Mike McGrath. That's probably the best thing. He's put his number out there.
I mean, essentially, you mentioned Noel Edmonds. I mean, he has also been very much involved in this. There was an article about him in our local paper here, the Bristol Post, saying police cover up Lloyds scandal, says Noel Edmonds. He's talking about £60 million of his money he wants back from Lloyds. He's quoted as saying a dark secret that is going to come out about Lloyds. He also cites the same business support unit and the recoveries unit as fraudulently taking his money, allegedly. So this is part of something that is called by many of the victims of Lloyds a bait and switch, which is where contracts are changed and the people who have taken the loans out aren't even told. And there's more as well, because more recently than that, on the BBC, we had an article saying on the 29th of March, MPs call for inquiry into alleged forgery of signatures by Lloyds Bank. This is the Treasury Select Committee. They want the Lloyds Chief Executive Antonio Horta Osorio to come and give evidence before them, because they believe that his staff have been forging signatures on court documents and this sort of thing, or documents which have been submitted to the court. Now, I mean, this is a very old-fashioned, what I suppose you might call white-collar crime, the idea of signature forgery, but obviously the Treasury Select Committee, Carolyn, are taking it seriously.
Well, I was asked to hand some evidence that I have. I have around about 20 signatures from John Holliday from various people, and there is significant difference in some of those signatures. I actually got a handwriting expert to analyse two of the signatures, and they came back saying that they were not by the same hand.
So why aren't the police? Why aren't the police prosecuting Lloyds Bank?
I don't know. There seems to be some reason why. I mean, it is blatant fraud. You know, we as a group, we are an action group. As a group, we are at a loss. Who would, you know, what to do unless we actually take the step of taking out a private criminal prosecution.
Is that likely?
I think they've pushed us to the point where we haven't got much option, to be honest.
Okay, so the website is no www, well, you can probably put that there if you want, but noel.world. I mean, he's obviously got a very interesting, being quite a celebrity, he's got an interesting address for his website. So that will be, just type in Noel, N-O-E-L, .world, and you'll find Noel Edmonds' website, where most of what he's saying at the moment, Carolyn, is about the Lloyds Bank fraud. Do you think it helps to have someone like Noel on board?
Yes, it does help very much. It has made a big difference because he's brought a huge amount of publicity. And I think as victims, we can actually see some action happening. But it would be very nice if the police actually decided to do something. I went with a group of other people to the meeting back in February, I believe, to Weston-super-Mare. And to my knowledge, so far, there still doesn't seem to be any action on taking up an investigation into what's going on. It seems to be like a very red-hot potato being passed from one to the other and nobody actually looking at it.
Yeah, what's worrying as well is the same with this VIP defile scandal, is that when the establishment is involved in crimes, it's using criminal methods to cover its tracks. Anyway, Carolyn Shires, you're actually from Farnham in Surrey at the moment, and a Surrey lass. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, that's Detective Superintendent Liz Hughes at Avon and Somerset Police, and Lloyds Bank victim of fraud, Carolyn Shires. Also, thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street, or on our website, dialectradio.co.uk. If you have some time to spare, you can volunteer with us or hundreds of opportunities in Britain elsewhere via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.